Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 314 for May 1st, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
It is clearly a very anal project, and I would be the first to confess that we're pretty anal in the way we lot of think about things around here. And
that's Mark Brown, the president of Buffalo Trace, on what may be the most extensive experimental whiskey project on record. The Single Oak Project, 96 trees, 192 barrels, with all of the wood for each barrel coming from the same tree. It's single barrel bourbon taken to the extreme, and I'll explain just how extreme later. Also, the debut of a new feature on Whiskey Cast, where I'll take your questions directly to the experts. This time I'll have your questions for Dr. Bill Lumsden of Glenmorangie and Ardbeg. Of course, we'll look at the emails of the week, the calendar of events, and much more. First off, though, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. A quick update from Japan. Chris Bunting reports on his Nonchata blog that Nika's Miyagikyo Distillery has now reopened for tours. As Chris and I discussed a couple of weeks ago, Miyagikyo is in the Sendai region that received massive damage from the recent series of earthquakes. However, the distillery suffered only minor damage. Chris also reports that Suntory has now resumed tours at its Yamazaki and Hakushu distilleries, which are much farther south, but tours were shut down at both after the initial earthquake and tsunami. Back in January, we heard from Tim Morrison, the chairman of Adur Rattray and one of the sons of Stanley Morrison, who owned Beaumont for many years. Tim's latest project is a blended malt that's being called Rattray's Selection No. 1. He picked four sherry casks for the blend, a 1991 Auchentoshan, a 1990 Bal Blair, a Ben Riach from 1989, and a cask of Beaumont from 1981. It'll be available in the UK, Europe, and the US. I've mentioned McMira's plans to start exporting its Swedish single malts to the U.S. for the last couple of years, and now they're finally available in New York City. Jonathan Lux of McMira has been sent from Sweden to New York to oversee the rollout.
Now we focus on New York in the U.S., but we also have a couple of other markets that we look at. For example, we look at Canada. You know, they have monopolies in Ontario and Quebec as well, so we look at that market as well, and then we have a couple of other markets, Beijing in China, and we have a couple of European markets as well that we look at. But of course, U.S. Will be hopefully one of the biggest export markets for us during the years. But because we're building a new distillery now, we will start produce the whiskey in the end of 2011, and of course that volume will be on the markets from 2017. So then we'll have, you know, bigger volume for the exports. But of course, we want to start the work right now and find the right partners and, you know, the right strategy for our brand as well.
The retailers carrying McMira include Park Avenue Liquors, Astor Wine and Spirits, and Sherry Lehman. And if you're outside New York, all three will ship within the U.S. to states where the law allows. Speaking of the law, Georgia has never been known as a progressive state when it comes to liquor sales. However, Governor Nathan Deal signed a bill this week repealing the state's ban on Sunday liquor sales, effective July 1st. However, local communities will still have to vote to allow Sunday sales. Only two states still ban all retail alcohol sales on Sundays, Connecticut and Indiana. Joe Dangler is easing into retirement after more than 32 years at the A. Smith Bowman Distillery in Fredericksburg, Virginia. He's been making Virginia Gentleman, along with a line of whiskeys named after the various Bowman brothers, John, Abraham, and George. The distillery is owned by Sazerac, and Truman Cox is moving to Virginia this summer to take the reins from Joe. Truman has been the head chemist at Sazerac's Buffalo Trace Distillery for several years and was featured on Whiskey Cast in episode 171, back in November of 2008. The Glenlivet is getting a new look. Chivas Brothers is making some tweaks to the bottle and labeling for its core range from the 12-year-old all the way up to the 25. The 18-year-old also gets a new wooden presentation box. The new packaging will be rolled out worldwide. The owner of Jim Beam, Canadian Club, Laphroaig, Ardmore, and Teachers will also be getting a new look. As I've mentioned before, Fortune Brands is unloading its home improvement and golf equipment units and will focus exclusively on the spirits business. After the split is complete later this year, the company plans to change its name to Beam Inc. The drinks unit has been known as Beam Global Spirits and Wine for several years now. CEO Matt Shattuck will continue in that role after the split. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Let's check out the emails of the week now, brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. More evidence this week of just how close-knit WhiskeyCast listeners are, even though they may be separated by oceans. You might remember last time around I mentioned Dave Tanton's quest to find some dark blue Copita-style nosing glasses, and since the one source that we mentioned last week wasn't willing to ship to the U.S., I asked for your help. Well, three folks immediately stepped forward from Belgium and the Netherlands, where the online site is based. They each offered to help arrange for shipments, even going so far as to offer to send the glasses on from their homes if needed. I'd like to thank Bernard Vianen, Bob Wending, and Sjord Dehaan for coming to the rescue. I passed their contacts on to Dave. However, he says the Dutch website told him after that their glasses had been damaged by the manufacturer and were full of scratches, but they would only charge him 40 euros to ship to the U.S. So Dave is still looking for a source. If you have any suggestions, please email me. I'll pass them on to Dave. Had a lot of comments on the last episode in the interview with Charles McLean. Mark Newton posted this on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. I'd be intrigued to hear a debate between Charles and Jim Murray, especially on the subject of adding water to whiskeys. As I told Mark, that would be an interesting idea, but I've seen their travel schedules. I think it would be next to impossible to get both of them together in the same room at the same time for a debate. If you have a question or a suggestion, I'd love to hear from you. You can use the WhiskeyCast Facebook page or just email me. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. The emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com, and you can become a Whiskey Insider today. Coming up in a couple of minutes, your questions for Dr. Bill Lumsden, along with the full story behind Buffalo Trace's Single Oak Project. Let's check the calendar of events now, brought to you, as always, by Laphroaig. Whiskey Fringe isn't until August in Edinburgh, but Royal Mile Whiskies plans to put tickets on sale starting May 18th, and they sell out quickly every year. In the meantime, tickets are still available for the inaugural Whiskey Live Dublin, as well as the Spirit of Toronto, both are on May 14th, along with the Whiskey Guild's annual tasting cruise in Boston on May 18th. Of course, the Islay Festival of Malt and Music runs from May 21st through the 28th in Scotland, and Woodford Reserve's final Bourbon Academy class of the year is June 11th at the distillery in Versailles, Kentucky. You'll find a full calendar of events for the entire year at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. If you're already a member of the Friends of Laphroaig and live in the northeastern U.S., check your email for details on a special golf outing and tasting just for Friends of Laphroaig in New Jersey later this month. One of the fun things about being part of an interactive community online is that I occasionally get to take your questions and pose them right to the whiskey experts. I'm in New York with Dr. Bill Lumsden. We're in his hotel room down in the Chelsea district in a hotel that shall remain unnamed because they would not let us do this interview in the hotel restaurant. Why, we had to run up to Bill's room to do it. So I'm not going to mention the name of the hotel, but we're here, and I asked before the interview for you to submit questions on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, and we have a few questions that Bill has agreed to answer. And we're going to start off, Bill, first of all, with Ian Katunovich. And his question is, Bill and Glenmorangie have done a lot of different cask finishes, which have been generally quite well regarded. Are there any cask types the good doctor would like to experiment with but has not yet, or anything he feels is promising and is at liberty to discuss? And along those lines, any cask types that turned out to be unfit for consumption? A lot of questions there, Bill.
Yep, the three main questions there. In terms of things that I would like to try and get my hands on but haven't quite got there, I'm fairly keen to to try and get hold of oak wood from different parts of the world. I know very much the character that you get from American oak, from French oak, from Spanish oak, but I'm interested to see what the flavours would be from using oak wood, particularly from Asia. There's various different types of oak wood. It's not easy to come by. I've read a lot about Japanese oak, which I think has some very particular flavour characteristics, but the small amount of Japanese oak that there is, our Japanese friends, the distillers over there, pretty much keep that to themselves. So I'm trying to get my hands on that. So, you know, watch this space. Maybe over the next 3 to 4 years, I might have something there. In terms of other ones that I'm working on, you know, we've had great success using barrels from different vineyards throughout the world. We've had Romani Conti, we've had Chateau d'Yquem, we've had Chateau Margaux, etc., etc. But, you know, there's more than just cult French wines. There's one or two other countries that make some fantastic and very much sought after cult wines. There's one in particular that I've always been intrigued by. It's one of my favourite wines. You know, this is the wine that defined a category which is known as the so-called super something or others. So watch this space, I'm working on that. And in terms of things that didn't quite work so well, I've had two very notable failures. The first of these is where I took 10-year-old Glenmorangie out of the American oak and transferred it into small barrels I had made out of Brazilian cherry wood. I couldn't actually have called this legally Scotch whisky at the end of the day. My friends in the Scotch Whisky Association made it very plain to me that would be the case, but I wouldn't have wanted to anyway because the end result tasted a bit like furniture polish. So not a great success. And the other one which always sticks in my mind was Hungarian Tokaj. You know, there's quite a few Tokaj wood finishes out there, but I'm pleased to say that as usual, we were the first to do that. I got Tokaj barrels many, many years ago. And after 6 months, the 10-year-old Glenmorangie, 6 months in Tokaj, was absolutely spectacular. It was beautiful, fragrant, complex. For whatever reason, I then forgot about it. 2 years later, it had completely killed it. The wood had taken over, and it was very, very bitter and harsh. So unfortunately, that went down the drain.
Our next question comes from John Burns, and he wants to know, can you ask why the cask finishes don't like air? My Quinta Rubin and Nectar d'Or were really poor after 2 months in an open bottle, and I would not buy any of them again after this experience. And when we talked about this beforehand, you thought it might have something to do with the way the bottles were stored, but if it's just these two bottles and not the other bottles in his collection, could there be something else at play here?
You know, I'm quite surprised at that one, Mark, because it's not generally something I hear from consumers. You know, Glenmorangie is very, very consistent, and just about the only complaints we tend to get are as a result of cork taint. And, you know, using a cork capsule, it's an occupational hazard, you might get that. But in this situation, I really don't know quite what's happening here, and I can only but assume that maybe the bottles have been stored unsympathetically. You know, maybe it's been stored in warm conditions or something like that. But, you know, the usual rules apply. Store the bottles upright, keep the stopper on, keep it closed and keep it out of direct sunlight and heat, and it should be okay. But what I would urge the gentleman to do is to return the bottles to Moët Hennessy and let us have a look at them. And, you know, we will replace the bottles, but that's not a complaint I've heard before. So, like I say, I'm wondering whether they've been drunk in, I don't know, a room that's got lots of other background smells or something like that. But you shouldn't experience that, in my opinion.
And, John, I will get you an address to send those to, and we'll email that to you privately. One more question on the Glenmorangie side from Andrew Gold, and I believe, judging from his Facebook icon, he lives in South Africa. I have the Glen Cellar 13. Any chance of them repeating this one?
Okay. Unfortunately, we don't have plans to replace Glenmorangie Cellar 13. However, that style of product where the whiskey is all drawn from first fill ex-bourbon barrels, it lives on in the expression we call Astar. And in my opinion, I think Astar is even better than Cellar 13. So if the gentleman likes Cellar 13, try give Astar a go.
Let's switch over to Ardbeg now. We have a couple of questions. First of all, Richard Stridmark in Sweden asks, are they considering to install a kiln with the same properties as the old one to be able to produce some old-style Ardbegs?
Now, it's a very interesting question, and there's nothing would give me more pleasure than to invest in replacing the old kiln at Ardbeg Distillery. It will cost an awful lot of money financially. It makes no sense whatsoever. However, I am looking into this just now, and, you know, I don't necessarily have to install a kiln at Ardbeg to bring about that style of whiskey, so I am actively looking at different ways of doing this. But, you know, no immediate plans to do so, but it's very much a dream I have of reinstating the maltings.
Is this something that you can work on, say, with the folks at Port Allen Maltings to be able to try to replicate that style as closely as possible?
Not necessarily with Port Allen, but I am speaking to one maltster just now, looking at doing various bits and pieces.
Now, our next question comes from Martin Roberts, who wants to know more about Islay maturation for Ardbeg. He wants to know, and has a couple of questions here, how much is now matured on the island? After new warehouses are built, then how much can they store? And also, what's the output of Ardbeg at the moment, and will they fill more into sherry wood?
Okay, again, various different parts to that question. Currently, we have about 90% of our Ardbeg stock is maturing on the island itself, and it is my intention to move that as close to 100% as I can get. So going forward, I intend to have all Ardbeg whiskey distilled and matured at the distillery itself. We will be investing in some new warehouses there, maybe start building them over the next 2 to 3 years, and I do intend to build at least one old-fashioned traditional dunnage warehouse there. Production capacity at Ardbeg, if I really squeezed the distillery and ran it flat out, we could probably do 1.1 million litres of alcohol per annum. We're not quite running it at that just now. The absolute level is confidential, but suffice to say, there is plenty spirit being laid down to satisfy the needs of the brand in going into the future. I also agree that sherry wood works very well with Ardbeg, and whereas I wouldn't really take Glenmorangie New Spirit and fill that straight into sherry wood, I do that routinely with Ardbeg. And for about the last, nearly decade, I've been filling many new sherry butts, and I currently am filling about 500 sherry butts each year with new make Ardbeg, and this is to satisfy future Ugadal bottlings, but also for some other more limited releases.
We also have a question from Bill Myers in St. Louis, who was at the Ardbeg committee meeting in Chicago and tasted Alligator. And the question came up about Ardbeg Alligator. Bill says, were some or all of the casks level 4 Alligator char? Was the whiskey in these Alligator charred casks matured or just finished in these casks?
Yeah. Okay, it was made in pretty much the same way as I go about making a lot of my limited, Ardbeg releases. And by that I mean that over the years, I have done and continue to fill a lot of new Ardbeg spirit into many different cask types, and I use the whiskey from these experiments to form the heart of the recipe. So Ardbeg Alligator, and this is actually a sample from the first proper vatting for bottling here. This is 52.5%. So this is made up with a certain proportion of Ardbeg whiskey, round about 11 years old, which has been wholly matured in these level 4 new Alligator charred casks. And then it's been married together with what I would call classic Ardbeg, i.e. from ex-bourbon barrels. And that tends to be the way we do it with Ardbeg.
We talked about this briefly before we started recording this, and you're already working on Son of Alligator, right?
Absolutely. Yep, I have made another cask selection. I have put the whiskey together and then re-racked it back into barrels to marry, and this will happen over the next year or so. I can't say any more about this product because, I'm not 100% certain that this will be the next one. I'm fairly certain. So yes, Son of Alligator is now very much under development. So this time next year, I'll be able to say a bit more about it.
One final comment, not necessarily a question, from Bert Bruniel, I believe is in Belgium. He writes, I'll ask him my question if ever I meet him in person.
Okay.
So he wants to hold off on that question, but you are planning to be at Fagil this year, right?
Yes.
You were not there last year when I was on the island for the festival, but you are planning to be there this year, right?
Absolutely. You know, I haven't actually been to the festival now for many, many years, and I keep saying to myself, oh, I'm definitely going to go this year, but then something else comes up. You know, there's always lots of different bits and pieces to do. But this year I will be going. I'll be helping launch the Fagil bottling, and I can give you some very big clues as to what that is. If you think of the Glenmorangie Sonalta PX, which was finished in Pedro Jimenez casks, this is two PX butts, which I actually filled with new make Ardbeg, so I can't quite remember the age of it, but I think it's about 10 or 11 years old. So this is what the festival bottling's going to be. So lots of clues in the packaging with charging bulls and Spanish themes. And I am intending to give a presentation and tasting, and it will be a very, very scientific presentation. So a great one for the geeks, if you like.
What's with the critters in the naming of the Ardbegs? This with the alligator, and then with the charging bulls on this one. What's going on with the animals these days?
You know, to be quite honest, it's just coincidence more than anything else. And, you know, I sat down about 2 years ago with Hamish Torrey, the Ardbeg brand manager. And this is kind of the way the Ardbeg team works, in that I will reveal some of my ideas to Hamish, just in terms of new products. And Hamish was kind of easy-ozy about it until I mentioned the word. And I said, you know, these barrels have got, Hamish, they've had a real alligator char. And as soon as I said alligator, his eyes lit up, and that was it. He was off on this marketing route for it. So generally, I'll lay the cask down, I'll develop the idea. Hamish will then market it, and Rachel, my right-hand lady, she'll end up refining the product for the final cask selection. That's kind of how the team works.
Can we gauge any potential future names from the giant Ardbeg billboard that's just outside the window here on the side of the Moët Hennessy USA office? And if you haven't seen that, I'll post a picture of it up on the Facebook page. There's a picture of a bottle of Ardbeg and a giant elephant, and the text line is, one is wild, beastly, and untamed. The other is an elephant. And can we gauge anything from that about a future name for an Ardbeg expression?
You know, you've just given me an idea. This conversation, Mark, has just triggered something off in my mind. And, you know, we've got two different types of warehouse in the company. We've got traditional dunnage warehouses, or what we in the company call our jumbo warehouses. So maybe there's going to be an Ardbeg jumbo expression with a theme of an elephant.
You could have done that with the Ardbeg Moore that came out in those big 4.5-liter bottles a couple of years ago.
We could have done. And, you know, with Ardbeg, it's not so much a case of sitting, trying to come up with ideas. We have so many ideas that the challenge is to filter out some of the more silly ones. And, you know, if people are interested in learning about how we develop the product, the alligator story is covered in great detail in the new issue of Unfiltered, the Scotch Malt Whisky Society magazine, because I was interviewed for that about 3 months ago, and I'm talking about it in there. And there's actually a picture of an old-fashioned Ford Granada Ghia, which is where my original idea, I'll not tell you what the tenuous link was, but I don't know, it's a cult TV programme called The Sweeney, which I actually watched an episode of last week. It's a bit dated now, but it was an ultra-violent programme about the flying squad, the police in the UK, and that's where the original seeds of the idea for the product, which eventually became Ardbeg Alligator, came from.
We talked briefly a few minutes ago about Son of Alligator. How far ahead do you work in terms of coming up with new expressions?
I think you really have to work on three different levels. There's more tactical things that you can bring to market in a relatively short space of time. And that is particularly the case with some of the Glenmorangie expressions. You know, the wood finishes, if you like. this extra maturation, because you can take your existing stock profile and then bring a product to market in about 2 years. There are then some medium-term ones, like Glenmorangie Finalta, for example, where I laid down the smoky element of it a few years ago. And then there's very, very long-term ones, like Glenmorangie Signet. So I'm working on a number of ideas just now at the primary production level, you know, looking at the malting, looking at the fermentation, looking at different styles of distillation. But it's obviously going to be at least 10 to 12 years before some of these products come to market. So I've got three different kind of levels I'm working on.
And that doesn't count the experiments you do in the lab, just putting together stuff to see what might come out.
You know, that there's... at any one time, there's dozens and dozens of different experiments going on. So just, as I say, that hopefully some of them are going to bear some fruit over the next few years.
Once again, thanks to Dr. Bill Lumsden for answering a few of your questions. We will do this from time to time, and I will let you know via the WhiskeyCast Facebook page when to pose your questions for other whiskey experts that we'll be talking with in the future here on WhiskeyCast. This week's WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Auchentoshan. I spent the last couple of days in Kentucky with the folks at Buffalo Trace learning about the Single Oak Project and getting a real education about what makes bourbons unique. This has to start with a sad note. Several months ago, Buffalo Trace's longtime warehouse manager, Ronnie Eddins, passed away. Friday, as colleagues and a few whiskey writers gathered on a sunny afternoon, as Buffalo Trace President Mark Brown said a few words.
Once in a while, you meet a great person. And I had the privilege in 1997 of meeting several great people here at the distillery. And one of them was Ronnie Eddins. And from the moment I met Ronnie, you could tell it was going to be a wonderful relationship, because he and Leonard showed up in a meeting one afternoon and we just talked about whiskey and what they knew and what they had done. And it was an absolutely magical, enchanting experience. And the more I got to know Ronnie, the more I came to respect the tremendous knowledge that he had gained. And there is no question that under Ronnie's leadership and Leonard's leadership, we have been able to produce some of the finest whiskies that this country has ever seen. But that's not all with Ronnie, because Ronnie demonstrated a tremendous amount of courage in the last 5 years of his life with his battle against cancer. He never once missed a day of work. He never once missed participating. And I think that we wanted to do something today that recognized Ronnie in a way that he would really appreciate. And so what we are doing today is we are planting a symbol of Ronnie Eddins, which is a white oak tree. And as you know, white oak trees grow into very large, substantial trees with a tremendous amount of strength, which is exactly what Ronnie characterized. The last 2 days here, we have been with our writer friends unveiling the Single Oak Project, which was one of the great experiments that we have conducted here. And that project has been named in honor of Ronnie Eddins, because if it hadn't have been for Ronnie and it hadn't have been for Leonard, we would never have gone to Missouri and we would never have handpicked trees that gave birth to that experiment.
As Mark told me, Ronnie Eddins was the genesis of the Single Malt Project.
We were sitting in a meeting talking about aging, and Ronnie started to talk about the importance of the tree and picking different trees. And I must say, in the beginning, I was a little bit skeptical, but as he talked more and more, it became very clear to us that he really knew exactly what he was talking about in terms of where the tree has grown, how high up on the slope, the moisture level of the ground around the tree, the growth rings per inch of the tree, the fact that there is a difference in a barrel made from the top half of the tree versus the bottom half of the tree. And so that was the genesis for us. And we said, you know what, let's go and pick some trees, and then let's definitively try and prove whether or not they make a difference, the different parts of the tree, the different grains. And as we then moved forward, we had the idea to change some other variables. And in the end, we ended up with needing 192 barrels to test the seven different variables between recipe, between entry proof, between char level, the length of time you season the stave, the top half of the tree versus the bottom half of the tree, and then the three different types of grain, average grain, which is then coarse grain, around 8 growth rings per inch, all the way up to fine grain, which is about 17 growth rings per inch. And so we ended up with 192 unique barrels, all closely related to each other, but off by a variable or two.
And those variables can be anything from the level of the grain to the level of the char to whether it was stored in one warehouse or another. How are people going to be able to acquire these bottles over the next 4 years and be able to taste these differences for themselves?
Well, the first thing that consumer is going to need to do is have a very friendly retailer, because obviously we sell the goods to a wholesaler who sells the product to a retailer, and then the retailer will be responsible for getting the product to the consumer.
And as you're speaking, we're seeing cases of W.L. Weller, Ancient Age, and some other whiskeys being taken off to market. That was the truck that was passing by, but please continue.
So that consumer could go to a retailer and purchase a case of each release. Each release will have 12 different whiskeys in that case of bottles. And when they get them home, they can lay them out on a tasting mat. I think what we think will happen is that people will get together in groups. So if you have 5 or 6 friends, you'll club together, go to the retailer, buy a case, and then conduct a tasting. And so people can compare notes and talk and discuss in little groups about the differences in the whiskies.
This really is an education project, isn't it, as much as a distilling project?
Oh, very definitely. For the consumer, we're trying to provide lots of different taste experiences and then let them know what drove that taste difference. Was it the top half of the tree versus the bottom half of the tree? So hopefully they can have some fun learning about what causes a whiskey to taste differently. Was it the recipe? Was it the proof it was put into the barrel? For us, it's an enormous learning experience. We've already learned an enormous amount on the project about the differences that these variables make. But then we're going to get consumer feedback from the website where people have logged their reviews, and so we will build an understanding of what people who have purchased these barrels, bottles, will have learned about the whiskies and what they're telling us. And at the end of it, we're going to know which one was the most highly rated whiskey, and then we will go back and endeavor to make a lot more of that highly rated whiskey.
You guys have talked a lot in the last year or two about trying to reach the holy grail of making the perfect whiskey. Where does this fit into that goal?
Well, if one of these 192 barrels yields a whiskey that the whiskey writers give tremendous critical acclaim to, if someone actually gives it a perfect rating, we might actually think that we've found the Holy Grail. But as we know, when you find the Holy Grail, can you actually hang on to it? Because if we have a bourbon that scores a perfect 100, can we actually recreate it? And that will be an interesting challenge. So we might find the Grail and lose the Grail.
What was the biggest surprise to you in this whole project as you tasted all 192?
Well, the biggest surprise for us, when we put the 192 barrels into the warehouse, we had an idea that some of the variables would make a difference. For example, wheat whiskey versus rye bourbon. We do know that that produces a difference. But we have been astonished at the degree of difference between a barrel made from the top half of the tree and a barrel made from the same tree, bottom half of the tree. So we are noticing much more difference according to the variables than we would have expected to see. And that's been the biggest, and quite frankly, the most pleasant surprise, because it could give birth to a whole new generation of exciting whiskies.
It could also, as we were discussing, as we were tasting these whiskies, lead to a whole new rise in whiskey nerdism in terms of, well, I'm only going to drink whiskies that are made with coarse grain, top half, wheat recipe whiskies. Are you worried about taking this maybe just a bit too far? In terms, it maybe the way Elmer T. Lee might think, it may be just sort of overthinking this just a little bit.
Well, I thought Eureka, it is clearly a very anal project, and I would be the first to confess that we're pretty anal in the way we lot of think about things around here. And I think in general, there will be consumers out there that are really into the finer details. But I also think there's a vast number of consumers out there that will be looking for a more simple explanation of a particular whiskey. So I'm not terribly afraid that we're going to drive ourselves into wandering around a certain forest in Missouri, hand-picking certain bits of trees from certain GPS locations. But
what you might be able to do is, say, use weeded whiskey, say, know that you want those barrels, the wood for those barrels to come, say, from the top half of the tree, while rye might work from the bottom half of a tree, and specify those in the future to improve the quality of both, right?
Yes, I think we do believe that this is, in many respects, it's like Formula One race cars. Many companies have been involved in Formula One with the hope of actually helping their everyday whiskey making, and I think we're learning enough from this that we think it'll help us improve the quality of our whiskey, our everyday whiskey, and then I think it'll give birth to a number of new different expressions of whiskey that the public, consuming public, will enjoy, all of which I hope stirs up more interest in American whiskey making, which is unquestionably the best whiskey on the planet.
You locked the accountants away in a warehouse for the duration of this, right? Because this is, as we've discussed over the last day or so, a project that makes no economic sense whatsoever to any accountant. They would tell you you're nuts to do this. You locked those guys away in a warehouse for a while, right?
Well, one of the nice things about being a family-owned private company is that we have the ability to take the accountants and lock them up. So we haven't told them anything about this, and we don't plan to tell them anything about this project. As far as they're concerned, they're just barrels number 1 through 192, and no difference. But it doesn't make any economic sense. But again, I think we have a fundamental belief that if we can improve the quality and the understanding of the whiskey that we're making, that eventually that will benefit us on our main brands and new brands that we will introduce in the future. So this does have a lot of learning. Similar to Formula One racing, you can't generally as a manufacturer justify the cost of it all, but it does hopefully have some benefit on your mainstream business.
Master distiller Harlan Wheatley first told me about the Single Oak project back in January, but I had no idea back then what they'd already learned from those 96 trees.
What we're finding is there's a lot more focus on wood types and things that you didn't expect, like top halves of trees, bottom halves of trees, and how much of a flavor difference that does impact on the overall taste. The differences are subtle, but when you taste them side by side, they're significant. And the main thing is we're trying to understand what each of these variables are doing to the bourbon as we put it in, and trying to keep everything else constant. These are probably the first time ever that we're learning these things in a kind of a large scale project.
explain the different variables that you controlled for here, because most times you would never see this in at a distillery, because you're getting barrels that are made from staves from random trees, all the same species essentially, toasted to the same level, but you're not controlling for anything other than your regular recipe and anything beyond that. But you controlled for, I think, what, 8 different variables?
We did do 2 different recipes. We tried 2 different entry proofs. We had different grains in the wood. We did top half and bottom half of the trees. And again, all these things are designed to really narrow down specific. And the nice thing is we can have maybe 3 or 4 of these barrels that only have 1 variable difference. And actually we have about 12, I think, in each release that only might have 1 variable difference. So you're able to compare those barrels and base them on that 1 variable. So we're really getting kind of scientific about it. But
is it fair to say this is probably the most expensive scientific project you guys have done yet?
It's absolutely the most extensive. We're not only is the project extensive, but the release is extensive, because we have to get all these released at a certain rate, and it's going to take us 4 years to release it. So we're going to compile data for 4 years from all across the country, from customers. And once we get all that data together, then we're going to be able to analyze it. And so it's going to take us 4 years to even get the results. So, grand total, you're talking 4 years plus 8 years of aging. And, you're looking at a 13, 14-year experiment, to come up with what we think is some answers to questions on variables and within the aging process.
How do you then take the answers you're going to get and use it to change the day-to-day bourbon making process?
Well, it's a matter of understanding where the differences are. It's going to be, if we taste a difference, we're going to be able to narrow down those differences. We're going to be able to understand why bourbon's tasting the way it is. We might be able to come up with some tighter specifications to understand what we're after on the final taste profile of the bourbon. So it's really just about understanding what we're doing a little bit more. So,
and what you found, for instance, that wheated bourbons taste better with certain parts of trees, and rye-based bourbons taste better with other parts of trees, things like that, right?
Absolutely. Just on that specific example, the recipe made that difference. You put that recipe in barrels that are almost identical, you're getting those 2 different flavors. And then how is wheat affected? Because we have pretty extensive wheat recipes here, along with rye. So how does that barrel affect those recipes, and how are they different? So that's for us to understand that. So that way we understand what the best thing is for wheat or rye bourbons.
And all this just advances the process, right?
Exactly. It's just more information. We've been here, 240 years doing the same things. But the 240 years, all this is just going to add to it. All the database and institutional knowledge that we have now, it's just adding to it, that's all.
Tell me about the role Ronnie Edens played in this.
Ronnie was, of course, the key player. I mean, he has talked for years about the differences in the wood and the differences in the barrels and the variations that we have. And we really wanted to highlight that and allow him to basically explain that to the general public. And so what he did, he physically went out into the woods. He selected barrels based on these different variables. He basically handheld these barrels all the way through the process. And so he was the key player in the whole project.
And it's a shame that he passed just a few months before this would have come to fruition.
Yeah, he was involved all the way up until the end. He's done he's done tastings with us, like you say, we unfortunately lost him about 6 months ago, and so he didn't get to see the final release, but he saw all the plans. He was heavily involved all the way up until the end, like I say. So And this entire project's done in his honor, and you'll see that on the web and all the project. And every bottle has his initials on the back, so we're proud of that.
Ronnie Eddins will still be teaching whiskey lovers about this project. Buffalo Trace Marketing Director Chris Comstock developed the Single Oak Project's website.
We want to provide an experience for whiskey connoisseurs that get bottles of this Single Oak Project whiskey to be able to not only learn about how it was developed with video of Ronnie back from 1999 picking out the trees in the Ozark Mountains and counting the growth rings in the trees and determining how old that tree was and categorizing one tree from the next so that we can make individual barrels from these trees that Ronnie picked out. So hopefully it'll be entertaining and educating for people to learn how this all started. And then furthermore, give people an opportunity to taste and evaluate these whiskeys for what they are. And so a user on this website can log in and evaluate a whiskey based on color and aroma and mouthfeel and taste and finish and apply descriptors to those different whiskeys and then see what gave those flavors and those characteristics to the whiskey. We're going to reveal everything about the whiskey after they've had a chance to review it and then do side-by-side comparisons and taste one versus the other and discover why they taste different. Right, and see what other people think about those whiskeys. So it's really a forum for people to give us feedback on these different whiskeys and learn why they taste differently and eventually compile the data so we can better understand what people like and what those flavors taste like to them and eventually determine, hopefully, the preferred type of whiskey and what got us there. So it's a valuable piece of research and an opportunity for people to give us feedback and tell us what they think.
In essence, it's almost like the world's largest tasting panel.
Exactly. And there's going to be thousands of bottles out there and hopefully thousands of reviews. And power to the people. Let them tell us what the best whiskey is.
Now, with the 192 barrels, you're going to have about 73,000 or so different bottles, or bottles from those barrels that will be out over the course of the next 4 years. How is this going to be rolled out, and where will people be able to find these bottles?
That sounds like a lot, but it's really not a lot of bottles. You still only have 192 individual single oak barrel trees that made single barrels, so it's going to be limited. And it's going to be available in the U.S. We're going to release a new set, which contains 12 different whiskeys, every 3 months over the course of 4 years. So consisting of 16 releases. And there will be bottles available at different stores across the country. But, of course, if a store gets 12 bottles, that would be quite a lot considering how little there is.
And they'll get a case of 12 different bottles. They won't get all one of the same bottle.
Right. Every case contains 12 unique whiskeys.
So it's going to be pretty much impossible for somebody to collect them all unless they've got some really good connections with a liquor store.
It will be tough. It'll be tough. But there's enough variance between each of these whiskeys where even if you don't have every one, you'll be able to taste and compare and learn the difference between some of the variables and characteristics that we're examining, even with a handful of bottles.
Chuck Cowdery was one of the writers who joined me on this trip. He's been writing about bourbons for more than 20 years now, and I asked him to put this project into perspective.
A lot of times if you sit down and taste, say, any single barrel product like a Blanton's or Evan Williams single barrel, you can taste differences from barrel to barrel, but that's all you've got. You can say, okay, I taste a difference, and here's what the difference is. But why it's different, you don't know. You don't know if it's different because of, it's something having to do with the aging, because the distillate that went in was all the same. But you don't know what about the aging was different. Now it's almost like you catch your breath because you're tasting these things and you say, wow, that's different. I wonder where that flavor came from. You know exactly where it came from, because the only difference between that and the one that doesn't have that characteristic is the char or the tree cut or the coarseness of the grain. And so that I think is what's fun about it. And because they did it on such a scale that they did, it's going to be fun for a couple of years. It's not going to just be a one and done fun. It's going to be fun every 3 months when they release a new batch of them.
The first batch of 12 bottles will be sent to retailers this coming week. Again, there will be a new batch every 3 months for the next 4 years. And I know what you're thinking, won't those last few batches be much older than the first ones? The answer is no. All 192 barrels have already been bottled and they're being stored in a secure undisclosed location. A final note, I'd like to thank Buffalo Trace for inviting me to this event and acknowledge that the distillery did cover my travel expenses for the visit. By the way, my colleagues and I were also given the honor of shoveling some of the dirt onto the tree they planted to remember Ronnie Eddins, and I'd like to think we did it on behalf of you and whiskey lovers like you all over the world. This week's Whiskey Cast In Depth is brought to you by Auchentoshan, the triple distilled since 1823, and you can visit the all-new Auchentoshan website on the web at auchentoshan.com. So, what did we learn from tasting the first 12 bottles of the Single Oak Project? I'm not going to go into all 12, but I thought it would be interesting to devote the What I'm Tasting This Week department to comparing three of them, since the idea was to compare the differences between the various bourbons and not have them stand on their own merits just yet. I didn't assign scores to them. I'll do that later on after I taste samples on their own. To preserve the surprise factor, I'm only going to identify them here as barrels A, B, and C. Now, barrel A came from the top half of an oak tree. It had tight grain, around 18 rings per inch, and it was filled with a wheat-dominated bourbon recipe. The nose was soft honey, molasses, and chocolate. The taste started off with a caramel cola note, followed by a quickly rising black pepper burst that faded slowly to reveal vanilla and a slight nuttiness. The finish was long and smooth with a cola note and a touch of pepper. Now that's barrel A. Barrel B was just like it. The only difference was in the wood grain. 12 rings per inch instead of 18 or so. Top half of the tree, wheated recipe. The nose on this one, though. Muted spices, caramel, toasted oak, and vanilla. Now the taste had two levels of spiciness. A pepperiness in the front of the mouth and cinnamon at the back. And as they both faded, caramel, almond, and hazelnut notes came out. The finish was long and sweet with touches of caramel cola and molasses. Now for barrel C, exactly like B in the recipe and the grain, but the difference in this one, this barrel came from the bottom half of the tree. The nose was rich and smooth with toasted wood, leather, and burnt leaves. The taste was slightly sour and tart with a peppery touch, and the finish was peppery and tart as well. Could it be that nutrients from the ground only work their way partially up the trunk of a tree, in just enough levels to make a difference in the whiskey over time? Well, that's one of the questions they're going to try to answer. The first 12 bottles looked at just three variables: wood grain, the part of the tree the wood came from, and wheat or rye recipe. Future batches will look at things like char level, the proof of the new make, and warehouse location. In the meantime, you can find my tasting notes for more than 500 other whiskeys in the WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. By the way, we've had more than 17,000 downloads of the apps so far. They're free to download thanks to the Glenrothes and Ben Romick. My notes are also available at the WhiskeyCast website, and that's also where you'll find links to our Facebook page and Twitter feed, so you can take part in our cask strength conversation as well. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.